There are an incredible number of people missing in the Australian desert, suspected to have been murdered.
I'll throw you down a mine shaft and you'll never be found.
There are so many unsolved murders here. This is the Wild West.
You could not think of a better place in the world to kill someone and dump a body than the goldfields of Western Australia.
We have seen photos of his body.
Code 90, very decomposed.
How did he get down there? Did he simply fall?
Do you find that story plausible?
No, it's ridiculous.
And where's Jenny?
She was adamant that he was down a mine shaft somewhere.
Very hard to make a case for murder if you don't have a body. Very hard if you don't have a murder weapon. And the cops don't have either of those two items.
If you're looking to dispose of a body, an abandoned mine shaft is a pretty good place.
Don't take me to church.
A killer could dispose of a body, and no one would ever know.
I wanna be buried at sea.
Do you think there are people out there who know what happened?
I think so.
The problem for police is it's very difficult to gather enough evidence in a way that allows you to present it to a court. So sometimes the perpetrator in a crime can seem really obvious to somebody like me, and certainly to the families. The families can be absolutely sure that they know what happened or think they know what happened, but that's not quite enough for the police to be able to put a brief of evidence together, bring it to the court and be confident of getting a result. If they go too early, there's a risk of blowing it. If they go too late, there's a risk that the evidence will be lost. Kalgoorlie was founded in 1893 at the height of the gold rush, and it's considered the unofficial capital of the Australian goldfields. It's a great place now, quite safe. But it wasn't always this way. In the olden days, pretty much anything went on the streets of Kalgoorlie.
This is a town that through the 1970s, 80s and 90s was run by bikie gangs. This was a time when you could walk into the front bar of the Exchange Hotel and buy industrial-grade explosives for cash. You want a pistol? You go to the Foundry Hotel. ...24-hour boozers, legalised prostitution, awash with drugs. It was a town made for young people to party in.
28-year-old Lisa Govan worked for a mining company in a mineral testing lab, and her boyfriend, Tim Hamill, worked at the super pit.
Lisa Govan went missing in October 1999. I'd been in the job for less than a year. It had always been in the back of my mind that Lisa had disappeared. And so in 2019, I was a crime reporter and I decided that I was going to have another look at this case. The Govan family migrated to Australia in the late 1980s. They come from Lancashire. Her parents said that Lisa was always in the middle of any mischief-making. She was always up for a laugh. Social, energetic, bubbly. To be honest, they were probably characteristics that led to her being in the situation that she found herself in on that night in October 1999.
Lisa's final hours in Kalgoorlie started in this house in Cassidy Street.
We know for a fact that Lisa left her house to drop her boyfriend Tim Hamill off at the super pit. He was on the night shift. She returned from dropping Tim off at the super pit. It was only about a 10-minute drive. She had a phone conversation with her mother, very normal mother-daughter conversation by all accounts. She hung up, and that was the last time that Pat Govan spoke to her daughter.
Lisa Govan left her home on Cassidy Street for the second time. We don't know if she got a lift or she walked, but she only travelled a short distance to the centre of town, to the most famous of Kalgoorlie's pubs, the Exchange Hotel. Lisa had arranged to catch up with a work colleague for a drink, but it didn't happen.
The man she was going to meet at the Exchange Hotel did meet up with her much later in the evening at the Safari Club.
The Safari Club closed a long time ago, but CCTV still exists from inside the Safari Club on the night of October 8, 1999.
It showed her talking to friends. It showed her talking to a man that was very tall and very bald.
He would come to be known by investigators as the Bald Man, and he worked with Lisa at the testing lab.
What do we know about his connection to Lisa on the last day of her life?
I think he was sweet on her.
Lisa exited the club via the stairs with the Bald Man at around 4:30 a.m. on the morning of October 8. She briefly attended to a female friend of hers that she was concerned about, and then Lisa hopped into a taxi with the Bald Man.
He and Lisa were going to go back to his house. Lisa, at the last minute, as the cab was pulling out from the Safari, said, "No, I don't want to leave my friend behind." Lisa went back to the Safari nightclub to make sure that her friend was okay.
All right.
The Bald Man continued back to his house, and he expected Lisa to arrive back there soon after. She never did.
Where did she go?
She went to the Kalgoorlie clubhouse of the Club Darrow's Bikey Gang.
This shed is all that remains of the Club Darrow's clubhouse on Boulder Road. In the 1990s, there were two dominant bikey gangs in Kalgoorlie, the Gypsy Jokers and the Club Darrow's. Each had their own clubhouse.
You didn't have to be a bikie or a gang associate to actually end up in a bikie clubhouse. You could be invited back. And members of the public used to covet that invitation. It was a badge of honour for them.
Police spoke to at least six eyewitnesses who were inside the clubhouse that morning, and they all confirmed that Lisa was there. But that's not the last place she was seen alive.
Police had at least two eyewitnesses that put her outside the Club Darrow clubhouse sometime between 7:30 and 7:45. She was reported missing by her boyfriend, Tim. But he didn't report her missing to police for a couple of days.
Why was that?
It wasn't unusual for her to go missing for a couple of days. That's the reality. She liked to party. She had friends all over Kalgoorlie. This was a party town where you could drink 24 hours a day. He does eventually make some inquiries about where she is, and by the next day is genuinely concerned. He rang Lisa's parents and they said that he was a gibbering mess on the phone when they spoke to him, terribly worried about what had happened to Lisa.
And in your view, did police treat the disappearance of Lisa with sufficient seriousness early on, or were they perhaps also thinking that it might be that she is still continuing her party?
It took a long time for the police to come to the realisation that she wasn't just asleep on someone's floor, that this was potentially a very serious crime.
One of the cases that we're looking at is the disappearance of Lisa Govan. Were you a police officer when she went missing?
Yes, I was. I was a policeman here in Kalgoorlie for 30 years. So, you know, murders, rapes, suicides, down to disorderly conduct.
And what do you know about that case? What can you say?
I wasn't involved per se around the table on that. I helped out going around interviewing people, going to businesses. Did you see?
He wasn't on the core team of detectives assigned to the case, but Kyron wasn't deaf to what his colleagues were saying about Lisa's disappearance.
The talk was that, yep, somebody within the gang, has done something.
Now, if that was the talk, you'd expect WA police to be all over the Club Darrow's clubhouse because that's the last place Lisa was seen. But that's not what happened. She disappeared on October 8, and yet police didn't search the premises until October 14. Why did it take police 6 days to enter the clubhouse?
Nobody knows.
What have they said about that?
They've never justified the fact they took 6 days to go in.
Wow. That's, not a good look, 6 days. You could cast aspersions as to why, right? Make sure the clubhouse is spick and span so that there's nothing untoward in there.
Does that speak to the kind of relationship that perhaps some police officers had with motorcycle gang members at that time?
It could have, if, using common sense, it could have. I'd wish it wasn't, okay? But there was an edict came down, and I don't know whether it came down from Perth headquarters or Detectives Kalgoorlie. We weren't allowed to go and kick a door in. We had to go through the detectives.
This news footage was taken in 1999. You had the Club Darrow's clubhouse, then a couple of shop fronts along, the Foundry Hotel.
One of the police officers in Kalgoorlie had a financial interest in the Foundry Hotel, which was the de facto clubhouse for the Club Darrow's bikie gang.
The best Christmas party of the year was the detectives, CIB. If you got an invite to that, it's a great night. And they had one at the Foundry Hotel. And so I go up to the bar and I'm having a beer next to three or four OMCG.
It wasn't uncommon for police and motorcycle gang members to be drinking in the Foundry Hotel.
No.
So then if a crime or an incident is said to have occurred at one of their clubhouses, are police at sufficient distance to be able to investigate it properly?
No. It will forever be remembered by their inability to crash down a door and get some critical evidence. That six-day window was the fatal flaw in the Lisa Govan investigation.
On October 20, in 1999, Kalgoorlie police put a mannequin on display. It was dressed in the outfit Lisa Govan was wearing on the night she disappeared, 12 days earlier.
They had a mannequin there near Bunnings and said, anybody seen a girl like this? Well, of course, yes, I had seen a girl like that.
86-year-old Robin Wade is still working as a diesel mechanic in the goldfields. But in 1999, when he was a sprightly 63, Robin says he saw Lisa Govan at a local McDonald's restaurant on Boulder Road at around the same time as her last reported sighting outside the Club Darrow's clubhouse. The McDonald's restaurant is just a few hundred metres away from the clubhouse on the other side of the road.
I'm witness to the fact that she was in McDonald's at exactly 7:29, 7:30. Walked into McDonald's, and when I did, I could see there was an air of apprehension, I suppose, and then I looked over and saw two bikies talking to a young girl. She had a mainly black attire. The dress was just above the knees. Her face was very red and swollen. She'd been crying and still was crying. The smaller one of the bikies was really giving her a hard time. The bigger man there, the tall man, he'd be 6'2", put himself in a position where the angry smaller man would have had to go through him.
Robin says that at this point, a short, angry biker left McDonald's in a huff, jumped on his motorbike and exited the property via Roberts Street, turning left towards the Goldfields Highway.
The other man then took this young girl across the car park and he mounted her on the pillion part of his motorcycle, quietly drove away, turned right. the opposite direction to the man who was aggressive, and then right again down Boulder Road and back towards the city centre.
Robin's eyewitness account clashes with that of the police, who say that Lisa was last seen at the Club Darrow's clubhouse. For Lisa to have returned to the clubhouse from McDonald's at 7:30, she and the taller bikie would have turned left from Roberts Street onto Boulder Road, not right. Unless, of course, they doubled back and returned to the clubhouse by another route.
So I called the police, called this number, and they said, well, it's 5 o'clock now. Will you come in tomorrow morning? We'll have you speak to a detective. So I sort of thought I would, and I went in. I had an appointment to speak to Inspector. And I walked in there, and his attitude was extremely frosty. The interview went on, I would say, maybe 45 minutes. I said, well, don't I need to sign that statement? I said, no, that's all rubbish. He said, I don't believe a word of that. Don't believe an effing word of it. And he discarded it right there in front of me, yeah. I felt very disappointed in the police force, yeah. After leaving the police station, I walked back, because it's only 300 metres, I walked back to my office and the telephone rang. I said, who is this? Because I was a little bit short. And he said, the Darrows. You've been to the police station this morning. You go near them again and you're a dead man. I said, if you want to talk to me, I'm in the workshop down here, right beside the railway station. I'm here now. But I said, I will tell you one thing. I have a fully licensed and certified 12-gauge, 5-shot automatic shotgun here. If more than one motorbike pulls up on my drive, I will not guarantee I will shoot you below the knee. I will not guarantee that. And they hung up on me, you see.
And he's always wondered, if I've never told anyone that I went to the police, how did someone purporting to be a member of the Club Darrows know that I was there in the first place?
If he's told no one else, he's gone to the police. If he's told his workplace and all that, somebody might, you know. But if it's come from police, yeah, that's not good. Not good at all.
I haven't spoken to one soul about it. Not my pastor, not a friend. That's the only way it could have come out. Only way.
Does Robin Wade believe that one of the men that Lisa was talking to could have been her partner, Tim?
Robin is convinced that the shorter bikie was Tim.
Was Lisa's partner, Tim, himself a bikie?
No. He walked like a bikie, he talked like a bikie, he acted like a bikie. He was not and has never been a patched member of an outlaw bikie gang. Robin described Tim to a T, having never met Tim. Tim Hamill was a short man, conspicuously short.
And it is the shorter man in this telling of the story that takes off without Lisa.
That's right.
Has anyone else been able to corroborate that story? Either the staff in the McDonald's, any other patrons in the McDonald's?
Police later went back to the McDonald's. The CCTV had been erased 2 hours before detectives arrived at McDonald's. Back in the days of VHS, you used the one tape and it was played over after a certain number of days. It may have been a week or thereabouts. The police seemed to be 2 hours too late.
A couple of nights later, it was semi-dusk, half light, and I was going over to my Okka truck. It's a high four-wheel drive and you've got to step on the hub and elevate yourself up. It's not something that you normally do after you're 60 years of age, but, you know, you swing yourself up. And as I did, there was a report, and this is the bullet hole here. I felt the wind of a missile go between the, just touched the back of my Cobra hat and my hair. A strike is a strike, a miss is a miss. And hey, they'll have to do better than that.
It sounds horrible to say, but Lisa, she drank too much. She made poor decisions. She'd hang out with bikies quite regularly. This wasn't the first time she'd ever been a bikie clubhouse.
She didn't do anything wrong, did she? She went out, she had some drinks at a club.
She did the kind of thing that thousands of people do every single night.
She was out having a good time in a fun part of the world as a young woman. She didn't actually do anything wrong, and yet it took a long time for police to treat her like a victim of crime.
It took years for police to have any sympathy for Lisa Govan.
Do you believe that police searched in what might be regarded as a professional and thorough way for her remains?
Eventually. In 2017, this is 18 years after Lisa went missing, the cops went back to the Club Darrow clubhouse and started cutting up the concrete floor and taking it away for analysis.
A new task force had been established, led by Detective Sergeant Shane Russell, to investigate the case step by step.
We've timelined Lisa very thoroughly from the morning she woke until her last sighting, all her movements, all her contacts during that time.
In 2021, police released previously unseen CCTV footage which showed Lisa outside the Safari Club on the night of her disappearance. Police had a new person of interest in their investigation, and they wanted everyone to know.
Who is in the new footage?
A bikie by the name of Andrew Edhouse, one of the most notorious gang members in Western Australia. He's a very senior member of the Club Darrow's Outlaw Motorcycle Club. He was seen outside the Safari with Lisa. He was talking to Lisa. Separate CCTV to that, showing an alleyway to the side of the nightclub, shows them both walking down and kissing each other. It's there in black and white, literally black and white, on CCTV from October 8, 1999.
Investigating the presumed murder of Lisa Govan in 1999, have narrowed their focus to the Club Darrow's clubhouse in Kalgoorlie, where they believe she died.
Do what you do to get by. Nothing's gonna save you from the devil inside.
One of the men inside the clubhouse on the day she disappeared was gang member Andrew Edhouse. He'd recently arrived to Kalgoorlie from Perth. But what caused him to relocate from the headquarters of the outlawed gang?
The Club Darrow and Coffin Cheddar motorcycle clubs went to war in Perth in 1998.
The war was triggered by the defection of this man, Kevin Woodhouse, from the Club Darrows to the Coffin Cheddars. Woodhouse left owing a debt to the Darrows and added insult to injury by switching allegiance to the rival gang.
There were tit-for-tat shootings across the suburbs. It was leading the nightly news every single night.
Coffin cheater Mark Chabriere was blasted with a shotgun in a drive-by shooting in Wolfpool.
Mark Chabriere, he was a coffin cheater. The police believed that Andrew Edhouse was the man behind the trigger. It was against that backdrop that Edhouse ended up in Kalgoorlie. He was just getting away from the heat of that particular war.
Police are adamant that Lisa went to the clubhouse. Do we know who the other people were?
The DJ from the Safari, a bartender from the Safari, a woman was there, a large Maori man. There's Andrew Edhouse and one other of the Club Darrows.
The big question is, was Lisa's death an accident or was she murdered in cold blood?
Detective Sergeant Shane Russell, He told you that he believes he knows what happened. Did he ever explain what that was?
No.
What's your honest opinion? What do you think happened to Lisa Govan?
All right, my personal opinion is that OMCG member or members have brought her life to an end.
Could that be accidental or deliberate?
Yes, and that's why I didn't say the word, I think she was murdered. I just believe that they were involved in her death.
If Lisa died in the clubhouse, by whatever means, whoever was responsible needed to dispose of her body. Would it have been relatively easy for somebody who didn't want to report the matter to dispose of her body?
Yes, yes, completely and utterly.
Do you believe it's possible that Lisa ended up at the bottom of one of those mine shafts?
Yes.
But how was she transported there?
Police are convinced, and they say they have evidence, that a Land Cruiser, white trayback, was driven to the clubhouse. Soon after Lisa was last seen, around 7:30, 7:45, that something was loaded onto the back of that Land Cruiser and driven away.
I know two people observed something being placed into the rear of this utility on the morning of Lisa's murder.
Have you spoken to those people?
Yes, we have.
And what did they tell you?
I won't comment on that.
Do they know what's become of the car?
There is a nationwide search as we speak.
Do we know where Andrew Edhouse is today?
He lives on a sheep farm in the middle of nowhere, about 200 kilometres northeast of Kalgoorlie.
Has he ever had any public comment to make about what happened to Lisa that night?
Never.
Have police spoken to him at length about what happened to Lisa that night?
He's refused to speak to police about what happened to Lisa Govan that night.
5 months after Lisa disappeared, Andrew Edhouse was charged over the murder of Mark Chabriere and two other attempted murders. But he was acquitted on all charges after allegations of misconduct were made against the police.
Hugs, smiles and Club Dero bikie Andrew Wayne Edhouse walks free from the state's toughest jail.
This is the most recent photo of Andrew Edhouse on the public record. It's from 2018. Do police believe that Andrew Edhouse has some of the answers to the questions they are asking?
Yes.
Is Andrew Edhouse a person of interest in this investigation?
Yes.
Early on in this case, there were two other persons of interest. The bald man, who was ruled out as a suspect after police searched his home, and Lisa's boyfriend, Tim Hamill, the first to report her disappearance to police.
When we went to see him in Cal, within a few days of Lisa's disappearance, he was an absolute gibbering wreck. He was frightened to death and he's muttering, "They'll get me."
We know that police have absolutely discounted Tim Hamill as a suspect in the disappearance of Lisa Govan. I think that Tim Hamill believed his girlfriend had met foul play and that bikies were involved. And in a small town like Kalgoorlie, that would be enough to send anyone into being a gibbering mess.
Lisa's parents, Pat and Ian, know their daughter is not alive. There's only one thing more important to them than finding her killer.
13 days from now, Lisa would have been 50. So
we just want to bring Lisa home and lay her to rest.
An inquest has never been held into the Lisa Govan case. Police are instead hoping to crack it with the aid of a blockbuster reward.
Today, the state government announced a $1 million reward to help catch her killer.
That money is available should someone come forward.
By the time the police are offering a $1 million reward, they know exactly who did the crime. They're just waiting for that final piece of the puzzle to fall in place.
You think this case is solvable?
I think the police will have handcuffs on whoever killed Lisa Govan in the next few months.
Lisa Govan wasn't doing anything that any young woman hasn't done. She went out that night, she was a friendly person, she was with people she knew, she had a few drinks, she was hanging around with some guys who turned out to be part of a motorcycle gang. Not that unusual in Kalgoorlie. There's no doubt in my mind that people who are missing need to be found. Charlie Park brought his whole family to the goldfields in the 1980s. He found work there in the mines. Kalgoorlie was and is the Wild West. The town has a huge number of pubs, many with what they call skimpies. Catering for the largely male, transient mining population. Charlie was a family man. He built a house in Kalgoorlie's neighbouring city of Boulder for his wife, kids and grandkids. That reflects his idea of the good life. Two bars, an outside living room with a fireplace, an outdoor second kitchen, a spa. For a working class bloke, this was the dream.
This is his bar. Charlie would always stand on that side, smirking, telling jokes.
And would he often have friends around here?
Yeah. All the uncles and aunties would normally sit around here. Us kids would be off playing, sitting on the couches. Yeah, it was a fun and happy time for my family.
Mark. Well, yeah, I'm Craig Park. I'm 52 years old. My father was Charlie Park.
Tell me about Charlie as a father and as a person. What was he like?
He was a pretty good bloke. Really good bloke. Funny. Generous.
He was sarcastic. He helped buy my first car. He brought my first car, and I'd pay him back every Saturday, $50, $100, whatever I could afford, and have a shandy with him out the front.
So he was teaching you responsibility, but he was also a really generous person?
Yeah, very generous, yeah.
Charlie was generous to a fault. If he saw someone who was in trouble, he really wanted to help out. And that's sort of what happened with Tracy, who was much younger than he was. Was Tracy Charlie's girlfriend?
Well, in a sense, but they were just best friends that I know of. They were best buddies and drinking partners.
She lived here?
I wasn't too sure, but she was always here when I called around. And I just remember them two always laughing.
Charlie went missing on January 3 in 2012, but it's important to look back at the events leading up to that date. Charlie and Tracy flew to Sydney just before Christmas in 2011.
Yeah, they went to Sydney because her mum was sick or something.
Okay, so that was, again, your dad helping somebody who
That's
needed
right.
help?
Dead right.
Charlie and Tracy stayed in Sydney for 12 days before flying back to Kalgoorlie on Tuesday, January 3. Later that day, Charlie went to his local pub, the Recreation Hotel in Boulder. He caught up with his mate, Chris Taylor, and they drank beer until 10 p.m. Charlie and Chris left the pub together via the Lionel Street exit. They walked four blocks until they reached Richardson Street, where they both lived. They turned right onto Richardson and reached Charlie's house first, because it was literally only a few houses along from Lionel Street. Do we know that he made it home from the pub?
Definitely. Chris walked him to the gate. And he walked into the gate, so he made it home.
Chris continued walking on to his place. But was Charlie's girlfriend Tracy there when Charlie went back inside his house? She told police that no, she wasn't. When she and Charlie got back from Sydney, she went to stay with friends until Friday, January 6, when she returned to find the doors wide open and the house standing empty. The only sign of life was Charlie's dog, Laddie, who lay bleeding in the front yard.
The dog was in a bad way, severely dehydrated, and Charlie loved his dog. Charlie would never leave his dog unattended. So that's when I thought, well, something's definitely not right.
It was Tracy who raised the alarm with police, and they, in turn, rang Charlie's family.
I walked into the back area here, and it just didn't seem right.
Can you say what it was?
I don't know, I just had a feeling. And the way Tracy was, I knew that something was wrong. Something's happened, I think, inside the home.
And why do you think that? Is that because of the items that were missing from the house?
Because of what was still here, and he wasn't.
The clothes that Charlie had been wearing were reportedly laid across a chair in his bedroom. His wallet remained, his passport remained, and his bank account hadn't been touched. Tracy told police that Charlie's bed had been stripped, his mobile phone was gone, and the council wheelie bin was missing.
He went to the hotel, and then he came back. And then after that, no more.
For a 66-year-old, Charlie was fit. He was still working. He had an active social life. But what about his mental state?
Is it possible that your dad committed suicide?
No, no way.
Definitely not suicide.
Why are you so adamant?
If it was suicide, they would have
found him.
Yeah, exactly.
All my old man was worried about was getting cancer. That's all he was worried about. There's no way he would have done suicide. No way.
And he was a happy person?
Yep.
Not suffering from depression?
No.
Enjoying his life here with Tracy?
Pretty much.
Police launched a search of nearby bushland and sealed off Charlie's home for a forensic examination.
Do you feel that the police did a good job at the house here with forensics?
Definitely,
and
yeah.
Fingerprinting?
Yeah, they went through the whole place. They did a thorough job.
Forensic police are examining Mr. Park's home, and it's understood several items, including a wheelie bin, are missing.
So this is one of the dams that the city has, which is, we've got quite a few, their water catchment areas, because we get very heavy, usually summer rains. So I came up here one day and there was a wheelie bin right in the centre of the dam, and it actually was slightly protruding. And because of all the rumours that was at that time, I actually said to the police, could they come and have a look? And they came immediately that day and pulled the wheelie bin out, which was actually very difficult because it was very, very muddy and there was only rubbish. But they were very quick in responding.
Copper there, she said to me, there's no body, good luck. And 10 years on, she was right.
More than a decade has passed, but for Charlie's family, it is still very raw.
What kinds of things was he into?
It's all about work. He never played any sport in his life, ever. Not even a game of pool, not a game of darts, nothing like that.
But Charlie was active with the local chapter of the Hash House Harriers, who described themselves as a drinking club with a running problem.
Somehow he came on one of our road trips, and then he kept coming on our road trips, so it was our road trips that we mainly got to know him. And one day we were in Southern Cross on a road trip, somebody said, Charlie, song? And he goes, I like eggs and bacon, I like eggs and bacon. If you think I'm going to sing you a song, you're fucking well mistaken. It just came out of nowhere.
Charlie's disappearance also came out of nowhere.
Everyone's got their opinion, their, you know, their theories.
Will it be someone he knew?
Well, they reckon 90% of the murders are someone that knew.
I wanted to understand more about Charlie and Tracy's friendship. 2 years after he disappeared, Tracy told a journalist that she loved Charlie. In fact, he had asked her to marry him.
But they were not intimate.
Had you ever met Tracy?
I have, yes. I've known Tracy. I knew Tracy from around the traps and everything, yes. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say that, from my understanding, she rolled in some probably different circles to what Charlie would roll into. Not the best circle, so to speak.
Right.
I know that Tracy obviously had issues with drugs and all that sort of stuff.
What do you know about that? Do you think there's any possibility that he fell in with the wrong crowd?
Maybe. Maybe he got taken advantage of. Maybe.
What would the wrong crowd be?
Oh, Tracy and her mates on the drugs and stuff, you know. There was lots of needles and shit around here, mate, when I come here.
Oh, I'm sorry. In August 2011, just 4 months before Charlie disappeared, Tracy was handed a suspended jail sentence at the Kalgoorlie courthouse for cultivating 22 cannabis plants in the backyard of Charlie's house in Richardson Street. Charlie was slapped with a $1,000 fine after admitting that he had watered the plants. His lawyer told the court that Charlie's crime was to turn a blind eye. So when Charlie disappeared 4 months later, talk soon turned to whether Tracy knew anything about it. In an interview with The West Australian in 2013, Tracy said that she fled WA because she was tired of stories that she was somehow involved in Charlie's disappearance. She told the journalist that she felt like she was going to end up with a hatchet in the back of her head. Does any part of you suspect Tracy being involved?
I doubt it.
I think that was just Tracy's friends that was introduced into Charlie's life that probably shouldn't have.
Did you ever suspect her of being involved in his disappearance?
In my own personal opinion, I wouldn't have thought that she would be involved, as in directly, whether some people that she was associated with from wherever, possibly.
Charlie was a very generous person.
Yes.
He was allowing Tracy to live here, and sometimes some of Tracy's friends, is that right?
I think it was just a one-off.
So that's Melissa?
I think so.
This is Melissa Telkesi. Jane first heard about her from Tracy, and the story she heard was that Melissa had started ringing Charlie and Tracy when they were on holidays in Sydney before he disappeared. Melissa was looking for a place to stay.
She was in dire straits, really. She rang, I know, a few times. And then Charlie did say, yes, you can stay until you find somewhere. And yeah, she was here when they got home.
Yeah, that's what I was told. Apparently she was supposed to be moving in here or something like that. Well, she was total looper, total looper. You know, like I saw her a few times and she just looked like something dragged out of the bloody pits, you know, like, yeah, she wasn't a nice person at all. And I don't know whether she came here on the grounds that she might get money from Charlie, I don't know.
So, was Melissa still in the Richardson Street house later that night when Charlie returned from the pub? We don't know. What we do know is that a few days later, Melissa turned up here at the Questa Casa.
My name is Fawn Galvin. My mother and I run Questa Casa, which is Kalgoorlie's only remaining original historical illegal brothel. Melissa came here looking for work. The only work which actually happens here is sex work.
Melissa didn't speak to Fawn Galvin directly. She spoke to a sex worker called Simone Kearsley, who was known to one and all as BJ. And BJ relayed the conversation back to Fawn.
BJ told me that this girl was trouble. She was involved in some way with Charlie Park's disappearance, and that she was also involved with the bikies.
T
10 years after 66-year-old Charlie Park went missing from his Boulder home, we're no closer to finding out who might have been responsible for his presumed murder. But Charlie's much younger girlfriend, Tracy, had an associate whose name was Melissa. Was Melissa involved in the disappearance of Charlie Park? Brothel Madam Fawn Galvin says she was given information to suggest that, yes, she was. It came from Simone Kearsley, otherwise known as BJ, a sex worker employed at the Questa Casa in 2012.
I normally found that anything that BJ said to us about what was happening in town was reliable information, but she was positive that Melissa was involved somehow and that he was down a mine shaft.
In 2014, BJ was caught up in a chilling murder plot herself. Drug dealer Beau Davis was attacked and killed by four men at his home in Kalgoorlie. They transported his body to another house in Boulder before dismembering it and putting the remains in a wheelie bin.
And they were cutting up the body and she walked in on it. She felt that if she didn't fall in line with them, she would end up chopped up herself. She went out and got cleaning stuff and helped them clean up the scene. Then she went to the police.
Simone Kearsley's evidence helped convict the four men when they faced trial for murder in 2015. She's since gone to ground.
I haven't seen her in years. Hasn't answered the phone. Had no contact with her at all since.
As far as we're aware, there is no hard evidence linking Melissa Telkesi to Charlie Park's disappearance. Just rumour and hearsay. However, what is clear is that Melissa issued some extremely distasteful Facebook posts in the wake of Charlie's disappearance, like these in 2013. And there's this.
I had a friend that felt sorry for her and actually took her in. And, like, down the track, she flipped out and she actually stabbed my friend in the face.
Are you familiar with the name Melissa Telkesi?
Yes, from my policing days, yes.
What do you know about her?
Predominantly, my memory is drug-related. One of my roles was to accept, receive and store all the drugs and keep them safe in Kalgoorlie. And her name came through more than once.
If her name comes through more than once, does that mean that she's a drug user or a drug dealer?
Yeah, she's a substance abuser.
When somebody has a substance abuse problem, do they sometimes fall into dealing as well?
Oh, the potential is there because they believe that the dealing then they can make money.
And if somebody is a drug user and a drug dealer in Kalgoorlie, is it possible that they are also involved with motorcycle gangs?
Yes.
Motorcycle gangs used to run riot around Kalgoorlie Boulder, but these days they keep a much lower profile. I'm told one bikie club is still active in Boulder, and that's interesting because a motorcycle gang plays a role in another theory about Charlie.
Around about the time he disappeared, there was a fire in a derelict hotel here in Boulder.
The disused Golden Eagle Hotel burned down on May 7, 2012, some 4 months after Charlie disappeared.
That was demolished very soon after, in a somewhat hasty way. There was a story going around that the demolition people had links with outlaw motorcycle gangs.
The The block of land where the Golden Eagle once stood remains vacant today. Is Charlie buried under all that dirt? Or is he somewhere else?
I've heard stories. I've heard rumours that he's been out the bush. He's buried, he's burnt. He's under a car somewhere. He's in this mine shaft, he's there. I've heard it all.
Charlie's family have also been forced to endure malicious rumours that circulate about his life. Thanks to a dreadful, unsubstantiated smear that was graffitied on the front door of Charlie's Richardson Street home when he was away in Sydney with Tracy, just before he disappeared.
There was graffiti painted about Dad being a paedophile and all that sort of crap, which is so not Dad.
Someone claims horrible things like paedophilia in against someone. You always look at your own dealings with him, and I never saw any part of him that was like that.
He definitely wasn't a paedophile.
Well, you spent your childhood with him.
I loved him. He was a great man.
Just when you thought it couldn't get any weirder, we've also heard rumours about an unholy alliance of drug addicts who live around Boulder. They call themselves the Mob.
My understanding is it's a collection of friends that work, that look after their own self-interest. But I'm all talking rumour. I don't actually know of anyone in the Mob who's admitted to me that they're in the Mob, so yeah.
Was the Mob somehow involved in Charlie's disappearance? Was Melissa Telkesi part of the Mob? The truth is, we have no idea.
The only way we're going to know is if somebody opens their mouth that was actually involved, you know, and that's not going to happen. Well, one of them's dead, so.
Melissa Telkesi died in 2017.
I think it was a suicide. My understanding was that she threw herself off a bridge. Oh. When somebody's in the grip of drug abuse, what's it like? What do you see?
Well, I've known quite a few people involved in drugs, and I've had them where they've even said, I'm trying to get off, I can't get off. And one issue, one problem is they try to get off, but they're surrounded by the people that are giving them drugs and or taking drugs, so they're not in a different area. But once they're in, very hard to get out.
Were you aware of any relationship at all between Charlie Park and Melissa?
Negative.
Whatever secrets she may have known, she took with her to the grave. In order to get some clarity about the investigation, I reached out to the West Australian Police. I asked them for an interview, but they declined.
When was the last time you got an update from the police as to what was happening?
Oh, I don't know. Not for years.
In terms of what police tell you, they haven't actually told you anything for a few years.
No.
And what about a reward? Was a reward ever offered for your dad?
No reward. I think Dad deserves to have a reward offered for his disappearance.
There's a lot of people who agree with Craig on that point, including the local chapter of the Hash House Harriers. Every year, they celebrate the life of Charlie Park with a big bottle run through the streets of Boulder.
Rewards have worked before with other people, so hopefully they might think about it.
Do you believe that Charlie was murdered?
I do. I do believe something's happened to him. Someone's done something to him. He wouldn't just leave.
Are we talking a crime of passion? Are we talking an accident?
I think it's an accident. I think something's happened that wasn't meant to happen. I think he's gone to the pub, he's had a few beers, he's come home merry. Yeah, something's happened to him here.
Do you think there are people out there who know what happened?
I think so.
I try to put myself in the shoes of the families, and I try to imagine what it would be like to have a member of your family simply go missing and to have absolutely no closure. Sometimes they hate that word, closure, because when something traumatic has happened in your family, you never really get closure. But you do need to know what happened.
He should be living the dream, and someone stole that. he was a loving man. Yeah, he deserves to be brought home. Sorry.
Had you ever given any thought to what you might say at your dad's funeral?
Well, no, I haven't. He knows how I feel.
I hope you get that chance, Craig. I really do.
Yeah, thanks.
I really do. I want to find out what happened to Charlie Park because he was a fantastic guy. He was a grandfather, he was a father. Everybody in the community loved him. There's no doubt in my mind that people who are missing need to be found. The families need answers. We can't let people get away with murder.
Lord, can't you hear me?